The Duval County School Board says no to teachers with guns. Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry kicks off his reelection bid, and it might take a little time to see that entertainment district built next to Everbank Field. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Rockin' Friday Media Roundtable. You can get on the line right now with your thoughts and questions and join the show at 549-2937. Then later, the history of St. Patty's Day in Celtic St. Augustine. Plus, famed ballet dancer Davis Robertson will be in town. We'll tell you why. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday and time for a weekly roundtable to discuss a very busy news week as we welcome Claire Goforth, editor of Folio Weekly. Good morning.
Good morning.
David Cotton, who writes for the Jacksonville Financial News and Daily Record. Good to see you.
Good morning.
And our own regular contributor, Fred Matthews, is here.
Good morning, Melissa.
Great to have you all here today, guys, and lots to talk about from the week. Everything from Mayor Curry's re-election bid and a new campaign-style ad that's already up. Also, there's speculation about whether he might draw a challenger. And also, later in the hour, we'll tell you about a snag in the Jaguars' plans to turn a parking lot over at the stadium into a downtown entertainment district. All of that ahead, but our top story this morning, Florida legislators are winding up their session in Tallahassee this week by passing the first gun restrictions in the state in decades. This after the mass shooting in South Florida several weeks ago at a high school in Parkland that killed 17 people. Now, Governor Scott has been sent legislation that would prevent citizens in the state under the age of 21 from buying a firearm from a licensed dealer. The legislature also approved some $400 million to pay for additional mental health treatment and school safety measures. Here's Governor Scott talking about the new gun legislation.
I want to make it virtually impossible for anyone who has mental issues to use a gun. I want to make it virtually impossible for anyone who is a danger to themselves or others to use a gun. I want to create a new program in Florida. I call it the Violent Threat Restraining Order. This concept is very simple and very common sense in my view.
Okay, so as this played out in the Capitol, people are watching the governor closely to see if he will sign the legislation sent to him by lawmakers. At the same time, the Duval County School Board voted 6-1 to oppose arming school staff. They also want the state to put armed law enforcement officers in every public school. We're going to begin the hour with a closer look as we take your calls. What are your thoughts about gun reform in Florida? And do you think Governor Scott should sign the legislation that's been sent to him? What are your thoughts about the local school board's moves? It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. We also welcome your comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. And Claire Goforth, let's begin with you. The local school board joined many other school boards around the state in voicing opposition to arming teachers. At the same time, all eyes are on the governor. Will he sign this legislation that's come to him now that is putting new restrictions on gun purchases in Florida, really for the first time in a long time?
Yes, it's the long overdue reform in some way. I do think that Governor Rick Scott's play is to sign the legislation, because then he can do his victory lap saying that I have signed the first gun reform legislation in all these years in Florida. But when we look at this particular legislation, what it contains is interesting. What it does not contain is just as interesting, if not more, because there's no assault weapons ban, which is what the vast majority of Americans do want and support, and has really been the rallying cry of the students from Stoneman Douglas. So what does this legislation really do? Okay, so it does provide some funding for mental health, which is great, but it doesn't restrict people who have mental health issues from buying weapons, nor does it restrict people who are subject to domestic violence injunctions or other sort of legal proceedings from buying weapons. And those are some of the common sense reforms that we've been talking about for a long time. I don't think that this legislation really will prevent very much in the way of school shootings, but it is a step in the right direction. I don't know if it's a big enough step, but at least we're seeing some progress on that front.
Okay. Now, this measure, it's Senate Bill 7026, the gun bill as it's being called, spurred by the Parkland massacre, also called the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School's Public Safety Act, would enact tougher gun control measures. It would also allow some teachers to be armed if the governor signs it into law, which we still are waiting to see. It would raise the age to purchase a firearm to 21 in the state, require a three-day waiting period for firearm purchases, ban the sale or possession of bump stocks. They allow a semi-automatic weapon to fire like an automatic. And more funding for armed school resource officers, mental health services, school hardening measures, and things like that. Now, as all of this is discussed, Fred Matthews, David Cotton, I'm getting tweets from people saying, for example, here's a tweet from the local Black Commission. We are concerned that SB 7026, arming teachers, is dangerous to Black students. That's something that's come up in recent days. The parents of Black and Hispanic children have a fear that their children might face the ire of teachers who have weapons. So as the governor contemplates this legislation, there are a lot of moving parts to this and potential political minefields. Fred Matthews, your thoughts?
Well, it doesn't appear that the legislation is mandatory. In other words, it's not going to be imposed upon each county around the state. As we can already see here in Northeast Florida, only one county, I think that's Putnam, Palatka, is the only one that's actually talking about having volunteer citizens, someone there other than the police officer to be able to be armed. All the other counties, Duval, Nassau, I think Nassau is included with us, Clay and St. John's have all said they're not going to encourage their teachers to carry arms. They're going to stick with the service officer. So I think that it will, we'll see this vary from county to county around the state. But, you know, the offshoot of this is that you can't complain this time that the legislature didn't do something. And this has attracted national attention. It's put Florida on the map nationally as being one of the first states in a long time to do anything, to say anything about gun control in a piece of legislation. And that's a step forward. As for whether or not something could happen to minority students, I think that would be the first thing that would pop up. And we've already seen that happen. I think, what was it, in Georgia? A teacher's already. We've already had somebody to pop up on the radar to use their gun, possibly. And that's always going to be a concern because, you know, we can't control what people do once they have a gun in their hand.
And in recent days, a couple of teachers around the state have gotten in trouble. One teacher down in Citrus County for being the host of a white nationalist podcast, for example. A teacher here in Jacksonville at Kernan Middle School has been suspended for using racially inflammatory language and things like that. And so, David Cotton, as that aspect of this is looked at, what are your thoughts about the Duval School Board? They took a pretty firm stand against arming teachers, as did a lot of other urban districts.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it speaks to a pattern that we're going to see across the state. I think the bigger urban districts are on the side of caution here, where I think the rural districts will maybe, you know, embrace this side of it. But I think, you know, like the stories in some of our done by some of our media peers say, you know, I think the school board here is looking at the legal side of this. You know, could they be liable if something wrong were to happen, if they were to put these guns in the hands of a teacher or a staff member that really doesn't need to have that responsibility? That's something that they're probably looking at very hard.
Okay, let's go to your calls. Do you think Governor Scott should sign this legislation? Where do you stand on this issue? It's 549-2937 as we begin the media roundtable this Friday with a look at the most significant gun restrictions making their way toward the governor's desk in decades here in Florida. Tim is in Atlantic Beach right now. Hi, Tim. Good morning.
Good morning to you all. And I just have a very simple, straightforward question regarding Duval County Public Schools. You mentioned the board voted 6-1 against arming teachers. I was wondering if you could just share with us who the one was who was not opposed.
That would be Scott Shine.
Yeah, Scott Shine.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much.
Okay. And to clarify his vote, he said he is against arming teachers or other school staff, but that the proposed law change would leave it up to school districts to decide. He He had a series of reasons why he voted against this. But David Cotton, you're nodding your head.
Well, yeah, and I think he's been quoted in a couple of stories this week as well after this vote. I want to mention one thing about Rick Scott real quick on this topic. Rick Scott has, when he was in Jacksonville and in other media stops, he has said that he does not like arming teachers. He does not like that idea. Well, if you're going to sign this legislation, I mean, are you flipping on that? Sorry, I just came to mind real quick with Scott.
That's a very good point. And I'd like to circle back a little bit to what we were discussing about how this may disproportionately impact minorities. Just to point out that in 2005, when Duval County finally got around to banning corporal punishment, that was on the heels of a Florida Times Union story that found that 80% of the students being spanked in Duval County were Black. So it's one thing for your student to come home having been spanked wrongfully. It is another for your student to not come home ever because of a wrongful shooting by a teacher.
I know that, anecdotally, Fred, this is something I've been hearing a lot about from folks in the community who have school-age kids. This is something that is worrying African-American parents right now. What do you think about this?
Well, it's akin to the talk. I mean, let's face it. I mean, we have a disproportionate number of into the population of African-American kids who've been under corporal punishment over the years. And certainly we've seen the data that shows the number that have been expelled from school, whether rightly or wrongly, disproportionately, again, with their numbers in the population. And this falls right in line with that, because the problem with having a gun there is what one teacher expressed this week. You can't, I'm a former teacher in the classroom. If you're in a classroom with fifth to eighth graders, you really have to protect your stuff all the time. And any kid can get, it is always curious about what the teacher has or doesn't have. And they can get into your drawer. Once you step up, you turn your back, they can find it. You've got to take an extra bit of care to protect your own goods. And when you're talking about kids knowing that you're the one in the school that has the gun, you're clear to do it, you can rest assured you're going to be a target to that. You can set, a teacher is being set up and can be set up in many ways with this, that they're not prepared. There's one more thing you got to prepare for. And when you put in one angry day that I come in, okay, one angry day that I come in, things are not going well. And I got these two kids in the back that are always on my case. That could be the day. And that's the concern that all of us should share. That could be the day that I decide. And we don't have any control over that. No one in the legislature is going to have an answer for that. They're just going to stand by and say, oh, that's terrible, that one thing. But it only takes one time. Just as you're saying, my kid doesn't come home that day because the teacher was angry. Okay? That's the fear. That's the concern about having this in our classroom.
And to be clear, just so I think people understand this, this isn't a fear I think most white parents have.
No.
This is a fear that Black parents have.
Yeah. But everybody should have that.
Yeah.
Because it can happen at any time. That's why we put former in Duval County. One of the better things that has been done is that we did put sworn retired and sworn police officers are the ones that man our Duval County police force. So they're already trained. Many of them served as service officers before we had the system we have now. So they're accustomed to it. Many of the officers who are in the schools know the kids that are there because they're in the neighborhood. They see them. They grew up there. We're talking about something different now, as a knee-jerk reaction that usually the legislature doesn't do. But this is a knee-jerk reaction to something without a whole lot of thought, no research at all. No research on this legislation. And by their own admittance, they didn't do any research on this because it came to them in the middle of the legislative session. There wasn't any committees.
And let me just jump in and say, this issue has completely crowded out all the other stuff that they were planning to do this legislative session. So let's take a few more calls. Mike is on the road back from Tallahassee. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Mike Stovall. I work with the North Florida Central Labor Council, and I'm actually coming back from Tallahassee, where I've been working with teachers from FBA, from poor counties, from wealthy counties, like St. John's, from everywhere from South Florida, where it's populated, the rural counties in the Panhandle, teachers are almost universally against this legislation. And another thing that they are against is the decertification of the teachers' unions.
When Mike, we're having a lot of trouble hearing you. I'm so sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, we can't hear you at all.
Yeah, but he did say.
But we get your point, Mike.
Yeah, teachers
okay.
are against it.
Yeah, they're yeah. Okay, thanks for that, Mike. Barbara in Ponte Vedra. Hi, Barbara.
Hi there. I just have one question, and that is when the police come to kill the shooter and they see three or four people with guns and one is the shooter and three or four are the teachers, how do the police know who the shooter is and who the teacher is?
Well, that's another point that's been raised in all of this. You know, how would police identify David Cotton? Again, to be clear, districts, I think, can opt into this or not. But what about her point?
Well, yeah, I think she's exactly right. I mean, we've seen during these, you know, mass shooting situations where, you know, the police officers are not necessarily confident in how to respond to a scene where there are no armed teachers as it is. And you throw more people in there in a heightened environment. It could be very easy to confuse the shooter for a staff member at the school. You know, to the other caller's point, I have several friends who are teachers here in Duval County. Not one of them have told me this is a good idea. They support the school resource officers. As Fred was saying earlier, you know, growing up, I knew who my school resource officer was. He was very involved on campus. But, you know, I haven't met any teacher friends who are like, yeah, this would be great.
Auden is on the south side. Auden, good morning.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Aiden. It's Aiden, sorry. Go ahead, Aiden.
It's okay. I've been listening to this for, as all of you have for the past week or so. It's incredibly frustrating because it seems like they keep creating this patchwork legislation. It doesn't make any sense. It seems to create, we're having discussions about problems we could create and not actually solve anything, and we're spending a lot of time on it. I guess my question is, what is it going to take to actually tackle the issue of semi-automatic rifles? Because nobody, it doesn't seem like anybody in the community has come out and said, hey, let's actually solve it. And that's what we're all about.
Okay. So then his question deals with semi-automatic military-grade style weapons. A measure to ban those in the state failed in the state Senate, I think, by 20-17. So it did get a vote, which is certainly a different picture from what you've seen in the past in Florida.
Well, I mean, you got the vote on bump stocks in Florida, which even the president could move. The United States Senate and House have moved on it and are not. So you got a vote on bump stocks, which is a step. You did get a discussion about automatic weapons in the state of Florida, which is a big step forward. Obviously, our version of the NRA here had to concede and allow the vote to take place because it's basically harmless is why it happened.
And what about Governor Scott? Because if he embraces this legislation, leaving aside the semi-automatic weapon debate. If he embraces this legislation, it will be a marked departure from his 100% lockstep stance on these issues in the past with the NRA. Because they do not support any of this, or, you know, the majority of this package.
Yeah, well, he's trying to appear more centrist so that he can run against Bill Nelson more effectively. I don't think there's very much of a chance that the NRA will front a further right candidate to challenge Scott in a primary so that candidate would then run against Nelson. So he really doesn't have anything to lose by supporting this.
Charlay in Riverside. Charlay, hello to you.
Hi. Yes, I have a concern about even allowing teachers in the state of Florida to have guns, only because we know that we have teenagers and, you know, kids that will get upset, fights may break out. But, the concern that I have is that the state of Florida has a law that will allow a person who feels threatened to use deadly force. What will prevent a teacher from using that in accident and end up harming a child? in class because all of a sudden they felt threatened. You know, teachers get threatened all the time in class. And that bothers me to even think of a teacher being armed in school.
Okay. Thanks for that. And thanks for everyone who's called in. A few minutes ago, somebody asked us who was the lone dissenting vote on the Duval School Board. It's board member Scott Shine. He's calling into the show. Scott Shine, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, good morning, guys. I just wanted to clarify a couple things. One, we're not going to put guns in the hands of anybody other than law enforcement in the school system. But in terms of why I voted against the resolution, if you remember back about 8 weeks ago, the legislature was considering allowing concealed weapon permit holders free access to schools. No one here is for that. I lobbied against that. The plan I presented, I may have been one of the first people to present this plan, was essentially what passed to the legislature yesterday. So the issue is, where are we today? What we had 6-8 weeks ago was concealed weapon permit holders. Today, anyone who may opt in, any district that may opt into this program, these folks are going to be at the auxiliary police level. They'll essentially be at the same level of training. And that was the initial plan that may have been changed in the last hours of the legislature. But that's why I voted against the resolution, because the plan that passed was the alternative plan that I put forward. So I'll let you guys get back to it, but I appreciate your show.
Well, no. Wait, 1 second. So as the lone dissenting vote, just so people are clear, you're saying you don't want to take a position to saying no to what the legislator is doing if other districts decide to arm employees. But what about, he hung up the phone. Okay. Your thoughts, guys.
I would wonder, because if everyone else voted as he did, then Duval County teachers would be permitted to carry weapons in schools. So I don't really understand the logic of voting as he did if he does not support allowing Duval County school teachers to have guns in schools.
Well, it's one of the things that we'll have to watch. Votes are important, and they also send a message. And this vote was about Duval County. It wasn't about the state legislature. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about there. Everybody pretty much knew. This was just a few days ago. That school board meeting lasted about 4 hours and some change. And it was right in the middle of it. There wasn't very many people attending, but it was clearly Duval County's message that they were sending to their constituents. And again, he was a lone holdout from that vote. And, you know, one has to wonder, you know, what that's going to mean later on down the line.
All right. Lots of people still wanting to call in and talk about this, but we do need to move on and make note of some other headlines from the week. The number to join us as we talk a little city politics now is 549-2937. Now, also making news this week, even though city elections are more than a year away, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry is already gearing up to go for a second term. He is running a campaign-style TV ad touting his first term in office. Take a listen.
Jacksonville is a city on the rise, with renewed optimism and new opportunities in every neighborhood. I promise to make a safer community my top priority by adding 180 new cops for our streets and 225 more firefighters. We invested in new technology to combat violent crime, working with law enforcement to ensure that we have the resources to keep the people of Jacksonville safe. We reformed the way our city works with schools by creating the Kids Hope Alliance. It's a partnership with teachers and the community leaders who help our children see their dreams become reality. We balanced our budget without raising taxes, increased transparency, and we're holding government accountable to you, the taxpayers. And when storms threatened our homes and our lives, we came together as a city to chart a course for recovery and growth. Working together, we're making things better. Now there's even more that we can do. Join me.
Sponsored by Jacksonville on the Rise.
And that PAC Jacksonville on the Rise is Curry's new political action committee. No figures to report yet in terms of their fundraising, but of course the mayor is expected to raise quite a bit in his reelection bid. Even though he's been through a rough couple of months, in particular criticism over discussions to possibly sell JEA, the city-owned utility, and the $64,000 question around City Hall is, will the mayor draw a challenger? David Cotton.
A serious challenger or?
Yeah, a serious one. Or maybe, you know, there may be a non-serious person on the ballot.
But, yeah, I mean.
But
look,
yeah, a real challenger.
You know, I think, you know, the two names, right, that come to mind, City Council President Anna Lopez-Brochet who's a Republican who has sparred against him all year, and Garrett Dennis, the Democrat chair of the Finance Committee. I've asked both of them recently, and they've both said no plans right now. Dennis a little bit more forcefully than Brochet, but Curry has now changed his messaging, right? Before this, you know, before he got elected, it was Jacksonville's kind of like not, you know, living up to its potential. I can be the guy to help it live up to its potential. Now it's, hey, look what I've done. Everything's great. And I don't know if that message is going to resonate with everybody. I'm just not sure that everybody agrees with that. I mean, crime has arguably not been lowered under his tenure. Yes, there have been some large development projects that have sort of gotten some traction, but in pension reform, but, you know, Kids Hope Alliance was a hot mess for a little bit.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it does seem like a long shot that any serious challenger will emerge to really take him on. And the number one reason for that is dark money in politics. I mean, he has this huge political machine. He's getting money poured into it by what was it that Marvin Edwards called them?
You're talking about the late
the
Marvin
syndicate.
Edwards.
The syndicate. Late Marvin Edwards referred to the donor class as the syndicate.
The syndicate.
Because they essentially like to run the city with their checkbooks. So that's not really unique, but it has been exacerbated by Citizens United over the past several years. And it creates a situation where the only way to get elected is by catering to these top donors. And that really doesn't resonate with the voters. And most of us are not wealthy donors. Most of us are just average people going to our homes at night and hoping to wake up in the morning and be healthy and be loved. These people, they want millions of dollars from the city budget to fund their projects. And they want to have reduced regulations so that they don't get in trouble with environmental issues and various other things.
Which we'll be talking about in a few minutes. But
we may well be.
Okay. So
dark money.
Dark money, not unique to Jacksonville, as Claire said. Fred Matthews, your thoughts?
I mean, the mayor's in a good shape right now. I mean, it is a lot about how do you feel. And for most voters, I would venture to say at this point, except for small groups around the city, they feel pretty good about what he's done. I mean, the pension reform didn't
cause. He has a record to run on.
Yeah, he has a record to run on. Pension reform didn't cause any of us any problems, and it didn't cause any. That's for the next generation. But in a word, it right now, it's JEA. How that is handled and where the money is going once this deal, if this deal is done, will have a lot to do about the mayor's reelection plans next year.
Let me ask this question to callers. If JEA were to be sold, taken private, would that affect your vote in the mayor's race? It's 549-2937. David Cotton, is this issue politically perilous for the mayor or not?
I think it possibly is. I think to this point, it's been very clear that whoever is pulling the strings behind the scenes, whether that is the mayor's office or the JEA board, it hasn't been rolled out the best way they could have rolled it out. I think it has been a bit of a PR nightmare for both the city and JEA's leadership. Yeah, it absolutely could be. I think that will be probably the one thing that an opponent can hit him on. As Fred said, you know, he did get pension reform done. He is pretty well liked among most people, I think. Average people who don't really pay attention to city politics, they don't have a reason to not like him. But he's also been raising money for quite some time. I mean, he took trips every weekend with the Jaguars, and part of that was funded, or, you know, that was funded by his other PAC that backed him. And part of that was holding meetings with donors across the country, Republican donors across the country. So he has been raising money as well throughout this process.
It is interesting that he brought in one of his top campaign consultants to work for the city. And I would wonder whether or not they continue to work on the campaign now that Brian Hughes is working for the city. That $200,000 paycheck, I mean, you know, that question could become, where does the line stop? Do you clock out at 5 and now we talk about your campaign? Are we, the taxpayers, funding campaign efforts? I mean, it's worth asking, at least.
Well, that's one of the reasons why in the special committee that's been put together to study the JEA thing, one of the first things that Councilman Crescenbeny and others says, how about if we subpoena people to come before us and let's have them sworn in when they testify before us? They're going to testify. So the general counsel's got to figure out what the punishment's going to be if they lie. And if they don't decide to come before the city council, what do we then subpoena them and hold them in contempt of the city council? I mean, that's how serious this business is, because there are some people who are bound and determined to get to the bottom of this deal and who started it and where. And that's going to depend a lot. That's a transparency end of the mayor's campaign that will really tell the tale in the next 5 to 6 months. As to what kind of attention he's going to draw. This is the thing.
But again, even if, and we're already getting a lot of calls on this, even if the folks, the voters, don't like the JEA business, if there's no challenger, what difference does it make if you're running for a second term?
Yeah, the press can rattle his cage, and that's about it.
Yeah.
Let's go to Ann on the north side. Go ahead, Ann.
Hi. I would be very much opposed to selling to JEA for any reason. But, of course, I've heard no reason why we should sell it. I've only heard about how much money we'd have in our pockets if we did sell it. So any vote for the mayor would be a no if the JEA is sold.
Okay, thanks, Ann. And let's go quickly before we take some more calls. David, the rationale for selling the utility.
Yeah, the rationale is you get this big lump sum of money. You can probably address some of the city's debt. You can get some of these major development projects off the ground that's going to require city money to, you know, clean up sites and that sort of thing. Yeah, Claire?
Yeah, I definitely have done some reporting on this. One of the things that no one has discussed, and I wasn't able to address it in my cover story this week because I just couldn't get enough information out of various parties. I was chasing my tail for quite a while. There's a roughly 2,000 JEA employees in the General Employee Pension Fund.
And full disclosure,
your husband is a JEA employee. Yes, and in the pension fund. But, you know, if all of those employees leave the pension abruptly, that could have long-term ramifications for the solvency of the fund. And it's something that would have to be analyzed by a consultant before we move forward.
Well, one of the biggest expenses you have with any business is the employees. And one of the things that's been done across the country, especially whether it's municipal or others, is getting out of these pensions and getting out of union contracts. And employees will pay the price for this. There's no illusions about this. Employees are going to pay the price if this thing gets sold. Because no one's going to want to take on that pension liability, and they're not going to want to deal with another union. We are a right-to-work state, and we have to remind folks is that, unfortunately, in many cases, the Republican Party has been stand forth against unions for years, and everybody in the union movement understands that, even though many of them voted for these candidates in the office. This is an indication. That's why the red shirts are showing up at just about every meeting, because they know that their jobs are on the line if and when this deal goes through.
Let's go to Rick on the west side. Rick, where do you stand?
Well, I think even the proposition to sell the JEA is a little bit suspect. People forget that only, you know, several weeks ago, Mayor Curry was flying around on corporate jets, hobnobbing with millionaires and billionaires, and suddenly comes up with an idea out of nowhere to sell a perfectly performing asset away from a public control to private control. It is a part of union or an aspect of union busting. It's an aspect of turning control of pretty much everything that is now government over to the private industry. The Republican Party wants this with utilities. They want it with schools. They want it with pretty much every government expenditure to turn it over to the private sector that doesn't answer to the public but answers to shareholders only. This is a national objective of the Republican Party, and this is a local aspect of it. Where did he come up with this idea? Why this? Why now? I would ask.
Okay. And that is a question, whether you're for or against it, that people have been, you know, just digging around on. To guys like Rick on the west side, it seems like this came up out of nowhere. But as we've been learning, this is something that apparently had been considered for some time, but just not publicly, correct?
That is the appearance, although they continue to deny it. It's just too many facts that go against that assertion.
The only thing that's being pointed to right now is at the exit of former JEA board member Peyton, that he suggested that they consider selling to JEA on his departure from the board, what, a year and a half ago.
Right. That informally had been floated.
That's what's being pointed to as the nexus for this. But there's, again, we don't have any evidence of that. Again, we must remind folks that there's no indication that the mayor started this discussion. There's no, it appears that the discussion did start at the JEA end of the street, but we don't have an answer for that that's clear enough right now to point to. That's part of what the city council is looking to do.
I mean, at least not on the record.
Yes.
I mean, for sure. I mean, you look at the board appointments that Lenny Curry made when he got into office. I mean, G. Allen Howard is a mergers and acquisitions attorney. That's what he specializes in. Aaron Zahn, who is the newest member of the board, mergers and acquisitions. Tom Petway, a guy who wouldn't answer my questions outside of that first when Public Financial Management made their report on the valuation of JEA. That's also a major donor of Lenny Curry. So to me, there is definitely something going behind the scenes, and it is our job as the media to find the paper trail and if it exists.
Anne in Mandarin. Hello, Anne. Thanks for holding. You're on the radio.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes, I support the previous callers. I'm against the sale of JEA. It is a public asset, and I see the possible sale of JEA as another short-term, getting rid of a public asset, giving it to a private company. Our utility rates will go up. We won't have any control or any say in how it's run. And the pension reform, as they call it, is a 30-year kick it down the road sellout. For 20 years, the Republicans were in control of the city, and they're supposed to be the ones that are fiscally responsible. And they kicked it, 30 years down the road. It's just irresponsible on both fronts, the way they want to handle both of those things.
Okay. It's not surprising a lot of folks might not like the look of this. I would, though, like to see some polling on this, and hopefully UNF's polling lab will do that if they haven't already done so, just where the public stands on this issue. Because, of course, we're getting lots of calls opposed, but I'd like to hear from both sides.
I might want to add here, there are two pieces of legislation that are being put out there, both one by Crescent Benny, one by Dennis, that basically will give us a poll. piece of legislation will take basically a straw ballot to see where the public lies. The second one would be, of course, once the city council takes their act, they go through their administrations to basically then go to the city, to the public again, and ask them whether or not they want to sell.
Sell on the south side. Hey, Sell. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I would like to say that in the long term, I believe the sale of JEA would be detrimental to the majority of citizens. And I would also like to say, if you bother to go to the JEA website and look at the senior leadership bios, three of those people on senior leadership, they look handpicked for the purpose of selling JEA.
Well, we don't know that,
their backgrounds, though, are in the privatization of public assets.
Yeah, okay.
It says so.
Thanks for that. Yeah, thank you for that. And David Cotton made a similar point a moment ago. But let me take one more call. Bron on the west side. Go ahead, Bron.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
My comment is this, that if it's a good idea for a private industry to come in and buy JEA, that means that it's profitable and they're going to make money on it in the future. Why wouldn't we then just, instead of selling the asset, why don't we just increase the rates to what they might go to if we did sell it to a private, take that profit and reinvest it in the city, and now we've got something that's producing the changes we want in the city without getting rid of our asset, and we do it on our own.
Okay, thanks for that idea. So whether you took Braun up on his suggestion or whether they privatize, I think one thing is probably a safe bet. We may be looking at rates going up in this city at a certain point.
I think it would be a hard sell for JEA to say, hey, we're going to raise rates on you guys instead of privatization.
But let's say Florida Power and Light comes into town. Rates are probably going to go up.
Well, the conundrum here is that this is a not-for-profit entity. It was created along with the other independent authorities for the purpose of making sure that we had a business mind handling these major entities and that they would all contribute back to the city's purse. We have business people in charge of these entities to make sure that they are solvent and they stay up. The JEA is no different. It just happens to be one of the biggest ones and one of the bigger contributors to the city's coffers. So we're already getting that. The rates are already lowered. One of the issues of getting rid of the coal-fired plant was because it was no longer financially feasible to maintain it. The cost of maintaining stockpiling coal was more expensive than it was to have it. So we moved away from that and got into natural gas. So we're running it according to good business practices now. The question is, who's going to profit from it? Right now, the taxpayers profit by lower rates, efficient service, a good workforce, by the JEA's own PR campaign. They're doing a great job.
Maybe you should be running comms for JEA, Fred. That was very well expressed. Now, speaking of business, profits, and fossil fuels.
That was a good transition.
You see what I did there? Yes. Also this week, it looks as though environmental contamination may hold up plans for the Jaguars to build an entertainment district in their parking lot. They want to do this right next to the stadium in parking lot J. But that used to be home to a fuel tank farm back in the days of the old Gator Bowl. And it's contaminated with old petroleum. Environmental restrictions put in place back in the 90s tightly regulate what kind of new construction can take place unless there's remediation. So the team is assessing the situation, but they say they're still committed to bringing an entertainment district to the downtown sports complex.
Yeah, this is something that we wrote about. I believe it published on Tuesday. And besides the contamination, this site was also part of the grant from the Florida Department of Environmental Protection that has Metro Park wrapped up as well from development. So there was some confusion from the city side as to whether or not the city back in the late 90s had actually removed this parking lot site from this grant restriction that restricts it to literally public recreation use. The zoning allowed it to be a parking lot. But as far as vertical development is concerned, I think the biggest question I have remaining here is who would pay for that? How much is it going to cost? And is it less than it's going to cost to develop the shipyards and the rest of Metro Park? And, what are the city's ties to that?
Right. Well, we'll continue to follow it. Finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from all over the state this week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. The Villages Edition. Yes.
There it is.
Only in Florida does a man steal an ambulance at, you guessed it, the Villages. 60-year-old Danny Canisi was transported to the hospital Tuesday, but was mad about the wait time to get into the ER. So he, just took an ambulance home. No big deal. It wasn't hard for police to track him down, though, since the ambulance was equipped with a GPS tracking device.
Who knew?
Go figure.
Did they take him to jail or the hospital?
No. Or the early bird special. Conuzzi did tell officials he did check to make sure no one was in the back of the ambulance before he took off with it, which was considerate of him.
Very responsible.
He's been charged with grand theft.
No kidding.
Get up to stuff in the Villages all the time. It's amazing.
A great place. You can live there forever and never leave. It's great down there.
Fred Matthews, who is living on the north side, living on a prayer, and a lot of other things. Claire Goforth and David Cotton, thank you so much for coming today.
Thanks, Melissa.
Have a good weekend.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. When people are hurt through no fault of their own, answering who, what, when, where, why, and how is critical to proving the truth. More at waynehogan.law.
The Chartrand Foundation is proud to support the Jacksonville Public Education Fund's efforts to acknowledge and recognize Duval County teachers. To learn more about JPEF's teacher recognition programs, jaxpef.org.
It's been a stormy week for the White House. The president's tough talk on trade has not gone down well with many in his own party.
No trade war has ever worked. We don't want to make America 1930 again.
West Virginians go back to school, and the opioid crisis shows no signs of getting any better. The Friday News Roundup next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Mohsen Hamid, whose timely best-selling novel is about knowing when it's time to flee your country and what happens when you do and become an immigrant in another country that's hostile to immigrants. Hamid lives in Lahore, Pakistan, but has also lived in California, New York, and London. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
I'm Ira Flatow. When did you first get captivated by science? Astronaut Leland Melvin says his interest was sparked literally when his mother gave him a chemistry set.
You know, I created this explosion. I burned her carpet. She ran in the room and, you know, I got a spanking, but my brain was activated to science.
Activate your brain to science on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, St. Patrick's Day is coming up next weekend, and St. Augustine is ready to paint the town green. In fact, you might be surprised to learn St. Augie is actually home to the oldest St. Patrick's Day parade in the world. That's right. Albert Sayelis is on the line. He's president of Romanza St. Augustine. And Albert, St. Augustine has New York, Boston, Chicago all beat. The oldest parade in the world, is that correct?
By 134 years.
How about that? When did it start?
Well, we actually had a celebration in 1600 when they fired the cannons from the fort in St. Augustine on St. Patrick's Day to celebrate the saint. And the next year, 1601, they held the first procession or parade for St. Patrick on St. Patrick's Day in St. Augustine.
How exciting is that? And, you know, there's a strong Celtic flair in St. Augustine. There have been Scottish and Irish governors, Irish vicars, and, of course, you've got your St. Paddy's Day parade coming up on March 10th in St. Augustine, and a big Celtic festival, too. There's a lot happening.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, everybody thinks of St. Augustine as that Spanish city with our wonderful Spanish history. The Spaniards that came here in 1565 also brought Celts with them, Spanish Celts. Our sister city is Avilés, Spain, is in northern Spain, and the people of northern Spain are Celtic. They still wear kilts and play bagpipes, and they have the second biggest Celtic festival in Europe in our sister city. And they have 100 bagpipes bands in competition every year there. So if they've got a big celebration, we're going to have a big celebration too. And it's working out very well. The Celtic festival here has grown in 8 years to actually have a reputation of being the finest Celtic music festival in the United States. We have 9 of the top Celtic bands in the world performing here this week.
That's right. People need to come out to the St. Augustine Celtic Music and Heritage Festival and also the parade, which is tomorrow. Albert Sayelis of Romanza St. Augustine, Aaron Gobra, a little early. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Drink a little green beer for me. And finally this hour, he is the founding artistic director of the New York Dance Project, director of the Bolshoi Ballet Academy Summer Intensives. And Davis Robertson is also a graduate of Douglas Anderson School of the Arts in Jacksonville, former principal with the Joffrey Ballet. In collaboration with the Florida Ballet Conservatory, Davis is bringing Boundless to town. This new show takes the stage tomorrow night in the Swisher Theater at Jacksonville University. Davis Robertson, a pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning, Jacksonville. I've always wanted to do that. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my goodness. You're a natural. And what a career you've had in dance, and you're bringing this amazing show to town. Tell me about it quickly.
Well, the career has nothing more to thank than Jacksonville and the talented teachers and individuals who made me who I am. I'm so proud to be able to bring back from New York to Jacksonville years of practice and talent and put this show together Saturday night at the Swisher, 7:30. If people want details, they can visit newyorkdanceproject.com. And we hope to get a full house, and we have a program of diverse dance set for everybody. So if you like dance at all, we have something that will tickle your fancy.
New York Dance Project, actually, .org, I'm looking at your website. This is amazing. You've not only done great work in New York, you're taking this all across the country, offering summer classes to kids and adults. And this show, we're almost out of time, but this show looks to be just a world-class performance. This is Boundless at the Swisher Theater on the JU campus tomorrow night, 7:30 p.m. DA's own Davis Robertson, star of the stage and ballet. It is such a pleasure to meet you, and this is going to be great. How can people really quickly get their tickets?
If anybody's looking for a ticket, all they need to do is visit Florida Ballet's website. We are thrilled to be collaborating with the Florida Ballet and be on the verge of celebrating their 40-year anniversary here in Jacksonville, Florida. We all should be very proud to have a ballet company that has been in Jacksonville for 40 years.
Absolutely. Davis, it's a pleasure. Have a great show. Thanks for stopping by this morning.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. That's our show. And thanks for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. And if you missed anything this morning, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. Also, don't forget to join us at 1 o'clock this afternoon for our new statewide program, the Florida Roundup. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.